On this President's Day, we'll have a little presidential history, plus GM shifts gears overseas, and the downside of house hunting when you can't afford one. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, February 17th. Good to have you with us. A big name in business news today is General Motors, which is taking a billion-dollar hit in order to scale back its global operations. The company has announced it's retiring its iconic Australian car brand, Holden, which means it'll no longer sell vehicles in Australia and New Zealand, with the exception of niche specialty cars. The company is also going to stop selling Chevrolets in Thailand. The big reason? GM's ambitions to sell more electric cars. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra reports.
20 years ago, about one-fifth of the new cars people bought in Australia were made by GM. Now it's less than 5%, and the numbers aren't much better in New Zealand. Carl Brower is executive publisher at Auto Trader.
The buying tastes in those markets shifted, and they shifted away from what General Motors was offering to what competitors were offering.
Competitors like the Japanese automakers Toyota and Mitsubishi. Also, for GM, selling cars in Australia, New Zealand, and Thailand came with an added cost. In all three countries, people drive on the left side of the road, and the steering wheel is on the right side of the car.
And that's not a small deal, because you need an entirely new dashboard. You need to reconfigure the entire steering system, which, of course, is next to the engine and transmission, so you have all kinds of changes under the hood as well.
Bernard Sawicki at the Center for Automotive Research says GM doesn't want to spend the extra money on engineering and making those cars if it's not going to sell that many. He says the company's decision to back out of the region is part of an ongoing strategy.
GM really has been very focused on eliminating lines of business where they don't make a satisfactory profit.
The company's trying to save money because it wants to ramp up its production of electric cars. And Sam Fiorani at Auto Forecast Solutions says that transition is going to be really hard for a company that's primarily been making internal combustion engines for a century.
Now we have to change the entire supply line. You have to change the entire development process. And so it's going to cost a lot of money, and it'll take a lot of money before they're profitable.
GM has been shutting down its unprofitable businesses for a few years now, pulling back in Russia, Europe, and India. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
President's Day is traditionally one of the biggest days of the year for mattress sales, and spending on sleep-related stuff is on the rise. Direct-to-consumer mattress company Casper cited the growing sleep economy in filings for its recent IPO. But sleep's role in the economy is about much more than spending on memory foam and weighted blankets. The Centers for Disease Control says a third of American adults don't get enough sleep, and companies are starting to wake up to the ways that can hurt business. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
Pete Tomczak's life has been getting busier lately. The Eugene, Oregon medical device sales rep has taken on more responsibility at work. He's also just started grad school and has a 2-year-old at home.
I can't afford to not be at 100%. And sleep is becoming ever more important.
When he doesn't get at least 7 hours,
I'm more irritable. Things that wouldn't normally make me upset me. I'm less patient.
Such pernicious effects of sleep deprivation haven't traditionally been a focus of the corporate world, outside of industries where safety is a concern, says Chris Barnes, a management professor at the University of Washington.
Maybe not as dramatic as having a nuclear meltdown or a bunch of people crushed in a workplace, but we're still suffering a lot of the same effects in boring white-collar office jobs.
His research shows sleep-deprived workers make more mistakes, are less engaged, and make less ethical decisions, all of which adds up to a significant loss of productivity. Wendy Troxell is a behavioral scientist with the RAND Corporation. Her research found lack of sleep in the U.S. contributes to more than 1 million lost workdays per year, resulting in a drag on GDP of more than $400 billion.
This idea that sleep is the thing we sacrifice to increase our productivity and get more done is just a sort of mortally flawed belief.
And more businesses are starting to pay attention to the importance of sleep. Mike Kish is the founder of Better, a sleep health workplace program that uses tracking and coaching to help workers get better rest. He says he's seeing increased interest in offering the benefit in industries like media, tech, and finance.
I think they're really starting to understand how poor the sleep health of their employees are and how that's contributing not only to lower productivity, but it's increasing their overall healthcare costs.
Inadequate sleep contributes to major health issues like heart disease, high blood pressure, and diabetes. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, U.S. markets were closed, but the numbers never sleep. We'll have details when we get there. Have you ever browsed real estate listings just for the sick pleasure of it? Maybe fantasizing about that cute little craftsman that's way out of your price range or wondering what your neighbors paid for their house? Turns out a lot of people spend time on sites like Redfin and Zillow, even when they're not actually in the market for a new place to live. Angela Lashbrook has some personal experience with this pastime. She wrote a piece on Medium's 1-0 with the headline, "Millennials Love Zillow Because They'll Never Own a Home." Angela, welcome to the program.
Hey.
So you start your piece with a particular home you found in Brooklyn that you fantasized about changing down to, you know, renovating the kitchen. What drew you to that particular place?
It felt reasonably sized without being extravagant. It was nice, but it wasn't, you know, a palace. And it was under $1 million, which in New York is like a diamond in the rough.
And yet, it's still, when you added on the homeowners association fees and taxes and insurance, it still was really an unbelievable monthly cost.
Yeah, it would not be affordable for most people I know.
And you discovered that you're not the only one who enjoys browsing real estate listings for homes you cannot afford. What do you think draws millennials in particular to that kind of fantasy?
I think for millennials, it's just that we're spending so much time online. And this is just a place where we can imagine ourselves in a new reality. So, you know, finding a beautiful home in, like, I don't know, Boulder, Colorado on Zillow, it's like, okay, I can imagine myself living in Boulder, Colorado in this, you know, cute little 3-bedroom with a backyard.
It's appealing, I think, to a lot of people to imagine a different life than the one they have.
Yeah.
But you looked into some kind of serious mental health implications. What does the research tell us about this kind of aspiration?
So it can have a multitude of effects for some people, depending on who you are. It could incentivize you to beef up your search or start working harder to afford it. For other people, it could kind of take the place of that ambition so that then you become satisfied by the fantasy itself and then end up not pushing yourself to achieve it.
Well, obviously, this gets at a really serious issue, which is affordability and the lack of affordable housing in so many, especially, big, expensive cities. You found that there are actually some mental health implications for home ownership as well, mm-hmm. which gets at why this remains such a key part of the, you know, sort of American dream. What did you find out?
It's interesting because a lot of people, after they read the story, or maybe they didn't and they just responded to the headline, hard to say, they were like, homeownership sucks. It's a lot of work. And it's like, it is, but it does pay off, like you noticed. It makes you feel more in control of your life, which is really beneficial for your mental health. And obviously you are more in control because it's your home. People who own homes tend to feel a greater sense of community because they're less likely to move around and they feel a stronger tie because they're not likely to be evicted, or if they want to make repairs to their home, they can. So altogether, it is better for your mental health, even though it is a lot of work. And it's interesting because I read this study and it looked at like elderly people who bought homes, and their health just got so much better after buying a home. So it's true for everybody.
Well, tell me about where you live now.
I live in Greenpoint and I absolutely love it. And I hope I never leave, but I'm sure someday I will.
And you live in an apartment where you mentioned you're so worried about the rent increasing that you won't even ask for repairs.
I know that my landlords are really great. I know that they would fix the heat if I asked without any trouble, but it's just an anxiety. Like, oh my gosh, like I have such a good situation. What if I annoy my landlord and then they jack up the rent? So I think a lot of people live with that fear. You're very precarious as a renter.
Angela Lashbrook wrote about an obsession with real estate posts at Medium. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
As cases of coronavirus continue to grow, there's new research out today about the economic impact. Dun & Bradstreet estimates more than 5 million businesses around the world could be affected. Nearly half are based in Hong Kong and another 19% in the U.S. At least 51,000 companies have at least one direct supplier in the affected region of China. We've got more about how public health workers get a handle on a global pandemic like COVID-19 could become. It's all on our Alexa skill. If you've got an Echo device, just say, "Make me smart," and take a listen. Now to a different kind of tech that's helping small businesses find customers. On Navajo tribal lands, one economic challenge is that people often spend their money elsewhere. The Navajo Nation's Division of Economic Development estimates that more than 70% of local income leaves the tribal area. When people go grocery shopping or pay for services in cities like Flagstaff or Albuquerque. From KJZZ in Arizona, Laurel Morales has this story about an effort to help native businesses expand their reach.
Tom Deal pulls a large silver and lapis ring out of a velvet bag and sets it on the table. Deal, who is Navajo, is soft-spoken, but get him talking about jewelry and he has a lot to say.
This ring here, if you look at it this way, it looks like a face.
Deal has been silversmithing for decades, but wants to reach more customers. At the moment, he sells about one piece of jewelry every 2 months.
I want to design class rings for high school students, but I want to work with turquoise, coral, and all those types of stones.
There's just one problem.
You would never know Deal Jewelry is here unless you know where to find him on Facebook.
Heather Fleming runs Change Labs, a native business incubator. She helped create Res Rising, an app that connects users to native businesses in the Southwest, like Deal Jewelry. The app cost about $40,000 to develop. The Navajo Economic Development Office estimates 42% of Navajos are unemployed, but Fleming believes many entrepreneurs are included in that number.
Native people are hyper-entrepreneurial. You see it on the roadsides, you see it in the flea markets. But when we talk about business on the reservation, people always say, well, what business? And that drives me nuts because it doesn't look like Sonic or Denny's or Walmart, then it must not be a business.
A lot of Native American entrepreneurs face obstacles. If they want to use Google My Business to market themselves, for example, they need a physical address. Many roads on the reservation aren't marked. It can be tough to operate a website. Only about half of Native Americans living on tribal land have access to high-speed internet. Fleming says small business owners also need an app that works with a flexible schedule.
Business is relatively informal. You know, one day I might be at the Tuba City flea market, the next week I'm going to be at Kayenta.
And all entrepreneurs need financial resources. George Joe, who is Navajo, used to run a business magazine that focused on Native American economic issues.
You need money to place advertisements in newspapers, buy radio spots, which is very difficult for many people on the reservation.
He says it can be hard for Native American businesses to get loans. To get the word out about the Res Rising app and its 600 or so businesses, Change Labs has spent about $50,000 on publicity. Much of that grant money has gone to marketing firms to recruit the first users, to manage social media, and pay for promotional merchandise. The idea is to appeal to tourists driving to the Grand Canyon. Instead of stopping at fast food chains, visitors can find a Navajo food stand. Singer Horse Capture, who did the research for the app, says she also wants Res Rising to appeal to people living on the reservation.
If they have like a car problem, they can go to Res Rising rather than just driving to Flagstaff, which might be difficult too if they have a car problem, and search for a mechanic, find someone who's also Native and who lives closer to them.
Horse Capture pulls out her phone to demonstrate how it works.
Right, what we have on the homepage is three different search fields. So you can look for a keyword, you can put in a location, and then we also have categories.
There's an agriculture category and a ceremony category. One thing you won't find is a rating system. Horse Capture says the business owners didn't want to compete. So users have to try a business for themselves and decide if they like it. In Flagstaff, I'm Laura Morales for Marketplace.
Coming up,
Washington was such a mess personally when it came to money.
Yep, that Washington, the one on the dollar bill. But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets were closed today because of the President's Day holiday. Across the Pacific, Japan's Nikkei index fell 0.8% after news the Japanese economy shrank for the first time in five quarters as a new sales tax hit business and consumer spending. Add to that the rising fears about the coronavirus in Asia, and the picture doesn't look too good for the world's third largest economy. Speaking of coronavirus, Apple warned today it won't meet its revenue projections for this quarter due to the outbreak, which has slowed down both production and demand for its products in China. European markets were better off. Britain's FTSE banked 0.3%, France's CAC 40, and Germany's DAX each rose by 0.2%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. We've got a podcast called This is Uncomfortable about life and how money messes with it. Sometimes the mess happens without us even realizing it. That's the case with this next story we liked so much, we're playing it again. Here's the host of This is Uncomfortable, Rima Crace.
Earlier this year, Hayden Aldrin, a 23-year-old college student from Idaho, started taking this sleeping pill, a really powerful one.
It felt kind of like I was on laughing gas to a sort, which I'm a Mormon, so I've never been high before. But I imagine this is what it feels like.
For years, Hayden had trouble sleeping, and this pill felt like a godsend. He could finally get a full night's sleep. There was just one tiny drawback. When Hayden takes the sleeping pill, he does things he has zero recollection of. When he talks about it, he refers to his nighttime self as subconscious Hayden.
So not only does he like know what things we want to keep secret, but subconscious Hayden also likes to buy things for conscious Hayden.
In the past year, subconscious Hayden has bought awake Hayden a nice sweater, black socks, a huge bag of Airheads, and a 5-pound bag of jelly beans, just to name a few things. It's been mostly trivial stuff. Then, one evening earlier this summer, this email pops up in Hayden's inbox.
I got a notification that said, your billboard is live. And I said, my billboard is what?
No.
And I went to the confirmation link and I had ordered a billboard in Louisville, Kentucky.
Wait, do you have any connection to Louisville?
Not at all.
So a billboard, depending on the location, can cost thousands of dollars. Hayden was panicking. What if he had completely wiped out his bank account? He looks more closely at that confirmation email, and it turns out he bought a digital billboard for relatively cheap, $100.
Seeing that it was only $100 was kind of like, whew, okay, thank goodness.
Okay, so now he just has to find out what in the world is on that billboard. He can't find any trace of it on his computer. There's no mock-up or Photoshop file. So he goes to the company's website.
So I download the image from the website, and it's just a bunch of clouds with my face on it. My face is cut out terribly, by the way. And then there was a little tiny airplane pulling a banner, and on the banner said, hashtag end chronic fatigue tomorrow.
What?
Which is so interesting because any call to action you've ever heard is like, let's do something about this today. But mine was like, let's end chronic fatigue tomorrow.
Let's figure it out later. Wait, I need to see this image.
I can send it to you right now, actually.
Okay. Oh, my God. Yeah, it's pretty much how he described it. It looks like something a middle school kid slapped together using Microsoft Paint. And Hayden has no memory of ever making it. You have like kind of a... like I'm looking into your soul kind of look on your face. Like, I understand you. Hayden says he knows that sleeping pills can have serious side effects. There's been warnings from the FDA about people doing things like driving or getting injured sleepwalking. He hasn't consulted his doctor about it, but he has told his parents, and they aren't too worried. Hayden says the real tipping point would be if he wakes up one day and sees that subconscious Hayden has spent beyond their means and he can't return it. But he doesn't see that happening.
I know that he knows all of my anxieties about money. And, you know, he knows that I have these accruing student loans. And so I think he's more of a, not as much of a prankster, but more of a gift giver to me.
He's got your back.
Yeah.
Or he says at least for now he does. I'm Rima Khreis for Marketplace.
Try, if you will, to get your head around this. The current U.S. debt is more than $23 trillion. That's the latest figure from the Treasury Department. It works out to more than $70,000 per citizen. But while the numbers are staggering, national debt itself is far from a new issue. When George Washington became the first president, the new government already owed millions of dollars. Alexis Coe is the author of the new book, You Never Forget Your First, a biography of George Washington.
Everything under George Washington was unprecedented. America was born with enough wartime debt to crush it, so it was one of the most immediate concerns he faced. The U.S. government owed $40 million in loans to Americans, and that's just American citizens. They owed $25 million to individuals around the world, and these are people we want to trade with and also people we don't want to owe money to, like France. We owed France $11 million, and they were going through their own political upheaval, their own revolution. So George Washington, to his mind, thinks we've got to pay these people off or we're going to start to owe them things, and we cannot ensure stability if we're vulnerable in that way, and especially when it came to France, because we didn't even have a navy. You know, we couldn't even send troops to back them up if we wanted to. Washington was such a mess personally when it came to money that I think his achievement was surrounding himself with good people, and in particular, Alexander Hamilton, who certainly ruffled a lot of feathers with his economic plans. He was the Secretary of Treasury, but he did a good job. Washington was pretty successful at paying off the French, which was a great relief because it meant we didn't have to join their revolution. We didn't have to fight the British on their behalf again. But the other debt, you know, slowly went down over time. If Washington was brought back to life today and shown how much debt we owed, I think he would be completely overwhelmed. In Washington's farewell address, he mentioned a lot of things that seem relevant today. He mentioned the dangers of foreign influence and of partisanship and of debt. He was really concerned that we would pass on debt to future generations and thought that was unconscionable. He thought that every generation should have a chance to flourish.
This final note on the way out today. Okay, you can relax, everyone. Jeff Bezos has a plan to save the Earth. Today, the Amazon CEO announced on Instagram he's committing $10 billion of his own to fight climate change. That's more than 7% of his net worth. The money will fund scientists, activists, NGOs, quote, any effort that offers a real possibility to help preserve and protect the natural world. No mention, of course, of Amazon's carbon footprint, which the company estimates at 44 million metric tons a year, about the same as the nation of Denmark. All right, we have got to go. Today, U.S. markets were closed. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Andy Corbin, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. Eliza Mills is our special project producer. And I'm Amy Scott. Kai will be back tomorrow. Have a good evening, everybody. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.